This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. On this episode, another trip out and about in the summer of 2017. Two stops today, Amsterdam's Riverlink Park on the banks of the Mohawk River Erie Canal, where the replica canal schooner Lois McClure was docked one day as part of its canal tour. Then on to Gloversville and that city's Fulton County Museum, 227 Kingsborough Avenue, where an author's fair was taking place in conjunction with Mysteries on Main Bookstore at 144 West Main Street in Johnstown. Riverlink Park in Amsterdam has been busy this summer. Thousands attended music concerts and fireworks on the 4th of July. One afternoon later in July, folks of all ages were coming to see the Lois McClure, a canal schooner named for a benefactor at the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum. The Lois McClure is a painstakingly made replica of a canal schooner, ships which were the tractor trailers of the canals following the American Civil War in the 19th century. On board the Lois McClure, I talked with historian and tugboat captain Art Cohn. In the conversation, you'll hear some trains passing by, a common occurrence at Riverlink Park, and Captain Cohn's little dachshund, Josie Wales, adds a bark or two. Well, we've made it to Riverlink Park in beloved Amsterdam, where we're on board the Lois McClure, talking with the man who's captain of the C.L. Churchill, which is a tugboat pulled up next to the Lois McClure. The gentleman who's joining us is named Art Cohn. Art Cohn, welcome to Amsterdam.
I'm delighted to be here again. I've been here a number of times, love the town. Love the new pedestrian bridge, and feel very good to be here today.
Tell us about the SS Lois McClure.
The Lois McClure is an 88-foot-long replica canal boat from the 1860s era, what they call the enlarged Erie Canal era. And that was when the original canal, which were celebrating the 200th anniversary of its construction this whole year, the beginning of that. The original canal, the day it opened, was so extraordinarily successful and so exceeded even the most ardent supporters and proponents' estimates that they immediately gave plans to try to enlarge it to allow for bigger boats to travel on it. Mm-hmm. And by 1862, they had completed the enlargement throughout the system. And the boat that you're on is a replica of a boat that would have been built literally that year to accommodate more freight to go through the system. And we know this because we've located two of these boats, exact examples, both built in 1862, intact and on the bottom of Lake Champlain. And over a 10-year period, we as nautical archaeologists documented, excuse me one minute while I keep my little dog.
He's got a little doggy there. I forget the doggy's name, but
Josie Whale.
Josie Whale, you've told me that. You got to be quiet, Josie. Oh, the cute, cute little dog. Okay.
Good girl.
So it's a, I mean,
it's an exact replica of two originals that still exist. Three-dimensional wooden boxes on the bottom of Lake Champlain that we were able to study, back engineer a set of plans for, and from those plans, some years later, we're given an opportunity to build one.
So, I mean, when the original was, it went on the Erie Canal in those days, is that correct?
It would have gone throughout the New York State canal system through the interconnected natural waterways, New York City, through the Champlain Canal to Lake Champlain to the Richelieu, through the Chambly Canal to the St. Lawrence, Quebec City, Montreal, Ottawa. All those places mm-hmm. were connected by the canals of the era, and the New York State canal system was probably the most successful.
So it had to fit. It couldn't be longer than the locks or wider than the canal or whatever.
That's exactly right. These boats were highly engineered to be able to fit the locks primarily and the canal prism of their time. If they were a half a foot too long or too wide, they would not have been allowed on the canal, and if they got on the canal, they would have plugged up the system. And so just like the trucks on the road today, which we frequently compare in terms of the function that these boats had in their day, the boats and the trucks are highly regulated so that the system can operate as a system. And so this boat would have been one of literally thousands operating annually to move the freight, produce, and cargo of all these cities and towns located along the waterways from place to place, and they were the indispensable links of the economy of their day.
We're talking with the captain of the C.L. Churchill, who is Art Cohn. We're here with his little doggie, Josie Wales, and we're on board the Lois McClure. Is it correct to say S.S. Lois McClure?
Well, it's really just the canal boat Lois McClure. She's actually a rare and an interesting boat type because, although your listeners can't see this, we're carrying a complete sailing rig for this boat. And that's a little bit shocking to people because a sailing boat on a canal, how could they possibly do that? Well, they couldn't. And this boat, although designed to sail, never would have sailed on a canal. But on Lake Champlain, we now know, for 20 years of research, in 1823, the year that the Champlain Canal was completed for through navigation from Lake Champlain to the Hudson, there was invented on Lake Champlain a sailing canal boat, a boat that could sail on the lake to the entrance to the new canal. There it would drop its rig and hook on to the horses and mules, just like any other canal boat, to make the passage through. And the two boats we located, one of them in 1980, appeared by shape to be the standard enlarged Erie canal boat. 88 feet long. We did two measurements. 88 feet long, 14 and a half feet wide. Got to be a canal boat from the 1860s. We knew that. But the boat also, because we're looking at an archaeological original, had elements of sailing. It had a centerboard. It had what we call dead eyes. It had remnants of masts and two mast tabernacles. And so I began to do the research for what type of boat we might actually have stumbled on. And I can tell you that the wonderful canal historians of the 1980s, when I contacted them to get identification of the boat, told me with out reservation that I must be mistaken. There never were sailing canal boats in North America. That was a European design. The design never made it to the New World, and I must be mistaken. And I was very respectful, and I remember saying, I appreciate what you're saying, and you obviously have years of study well beyond what I've done. I'm just a neophyte at all of this. But we actually have one. We have a real canal boat that has these sailing elements. So unless you can account for me why it's there, I think we might have stumbled on a small, and now we now know, because...
He's looking for a little prop here. There we go.
Over the last 20 years... we completed enough research to actually turn it into a book about the Lake Champlain sailing canal boats.
Oh, and that's your book, Arthur Cohn.
Yes, it's Lake. A book that I was very, very privileged to publish about 10 years ago, and it tells the story now of the sailing canal boats, their origin, their use, when they died out because the economics no longer made it feasible or desirable to build them. But anyway, that's what this boat actually is a replica of. So it's neat for people. They can see the hull type is absolutely typical. And so every canal boat that would have operated in the 1860s on the Champlain, Erie, Cayuga and Seneca, Oswego canals, they all were uniformly of this dimension. They might have had different hatch configurations. They might have been painted different colors. But the hull shape and size was highly regulated and would have looked just like this. The sailing rig, when we got a chance to propose a project to build a replica of this type, I figured, well, hook, we got a really unique slice of maritime history. Why wouldn't we take advantage of that? And so that's what we built.
More with Captain Art Cohn in a moment. This is Bob Cudmore. We hope you're enjoying this edition of the Historians Podcast. The podcast depends on your donations to keep going. We welcome contributions online at our GoFundMe site, GoFundMe.com/historians2017. If you'd rather donate by mail, make out a check to me, Bob Cudmore, send to 125 Horseman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. Thank you very much. Now back to Captain Art Cohn on the canal schooner Lois McClure. One thing I was wondering about, when the SS Lois McClure was in operation on the canals and sailing on Lake Champlain, did anybody take a picture of it? Weren't pictures possible
yes.
then?
In fact, the original boats themselves, we don't have a picture of, although we do have a picture of the type. And so in this little booklet, which I'm going to give you, which is presented to all of our visitors as part of our efforts underwritten and sponsored by the New York State Canal Corporation, we're attempting to share a lot of historical information. It is the start of the bicentennial. We're delighted to be a part of that. And you'll see in this booklet we have an actual photograph of what was then described on a postcard as an old-timer on Lake Champlain. Postcard was published about 1900. And then you can see our replica sailing in a similar tack on Lake Champlain the year that we launched her. And so you can see what an original would have looked like in her time and what we've restored by way of a presence, which is really part of the reason we did it.
What would the SS Lois McClure have carried?
Boats like this, like the trucks on the road today, essentially carried everything. So we know that they would have been high percentage of loads of lumber and building materials, bricks, agricultural products, manufactured goods. We have a canal boat shipwreck in Lake Champlain that has a cargo of kitchen wood stoves manufactured in Troy, New York, coal coming up from the Hudson via the D&H Canal and the Pennsylvania coal mine. So these boats were multifunctional in terms of the loads they carried, but everything coming into or out of a community prior to the railroads and after the canals were open would have been carried by vessels like this. And even after the railroads came, they carved out niches for themselves that were viable right into the 20th century. Iron ore, pig iron, heavy products that required the efficiency of buoyancy to move from place to place and were not burdened by the necessity of speed would have been carried on the canal. Just like some loads are being carried today, it's the same principle.
Did she ever carry passengers?
Not these particular type and shape of boats, but one of the really fascinating eras of the canal to me, and one that I'm a student of still, is when the canals opened, when they first, and even before they were completed, on the canals appeared the packet boats. And these packet boats all of a sudden took what had been a torturous ride on bad roads or on horseback, lengthy, difficult, long trips. If you wanted to go from Albany to Buffalo, it could take you 4 to 6 weeks and be a painstaking experience. All of a sudden, you've got a water highway. And so the entrepreneurs were ready for it, and they built these packet boats, which you would akin today to our buses. And they were express boats. They were sleeker than these cargo carriers. They were propelled by three horses in a line. They had right of way. They could travel at 4 miles an hour. They were the radical invention of their day. And people loved them. You could take them. You could eat on them. You could sleep on them. They had bars on them. It was an extraordinary transformation of moving people, and migration and emigration really got a jump start from that. And these boats dominated that passenger trade for about the next 25 years. And you can see the advertisements. We've actually reproduced one in this latest booklet we produced. And I am desperately trying to find an archaeological original on the bottom of some body of water, because they're one of the missing links in our types of canal boats. Interestingly, from almost the moment the railroads came, they outcompeted these packet boats. And so packet boats disappeared from society before the age of photography. Oh. And so we see them mostly in broadsides, advertisements, paintings, and they're wonderful glimpses of a boat type that changed the environment, changed the state, but did not last very long.
And maybe back to the basics, a canal schooner, which is what this is, right?
Correct.
Like the Lois McClure. It could sail, but that was only on Lake Champlain or on the Hudson.
Or in the St. Lawrence. We know they would sometimes bring their rig up to the St. Lawrence and sail up there. You know, the great incentive for them is it would save them from having to hire a towboat. Mm-hmm. They would be under their own schedule and operation. But as steam towboats became more prevalent and the price of a tow came down, the cost benefit of rigging your vessel like this, which was a extra expensive option, became obsolete.
Okay, I think you're answering the next question, which was, I mean, at some point, were these pulled by horses or mules on the canals?
Absolutely. This boat could only sail to the canal. When this boat reached Whitehall, New York, the northern entrance of the Champlain Canal, those sails had to be stowed on deck or dropped off at Billy Kane's Sail Loft and stored.
Okay, yeah.
And the owner of the boat would walk over to the mule shed or the horse stables, and he would say, okay, guys, I want to rent a team and a driver to get me through the Champlain Canal, 63 miles long. And that's how they did it. Mm-hmm. On the Erie Canal, we now know, because of the length of the canal, they often owned their own horses and mules.
And then at some point they would use, like you're doing today, have a tugboat or a steamboat next to it?
That would have happened even during that era in the city. So a small tug like ours would be considered like a harbor tug. So if I get delivered to New York with a tow of 80 other canal boats, which was not untypical, by the time I got dropped off but needed to go to another part of the city's harbor, a small towboat, harbor tug, I'd make an arrangement, I'd pay a fee, he would take me one-on-one over to the destination where I was going to unload my cargo. If I needed to get back to a collecting place to go somewhere else, a small tug would do that. And then when the modern canal was built, that is the canal you see today, the barge canal, which is in itself over 100 years old, that was designed, that did away with the old-fashioned towpath. And that was designed to move vehicles either under their own propulsion or by using a steam towboat. And that's the way that canal was designed.
So the C.L. Churchill tows the Lois McClure on your current trip?
Actually, on the canal, mostly we push her. Just like you see it, she's tied up on what we call the hip with four lines so we can push straight ahead or back, turn. And so she's essentially the auxiliary engine room while we're on the canal.
So, I mean, the tug stays right where she is?
Right, or switches to the other side depending on what wall we're going to be going on. But she's the indispensable power source for this boat on the canal. And we love the opportunity to bring this boat. If you look around today, you can hear the kids, the parents, the grandparents all looking at this boat and asking the same questions and wonderment. They're in wonderment of a boat that in her day people wouldn't have given a second look to.
Really?
Today she's a rock star, and we love it. We love it. It's a rock star for history. This canal history is so special, and New York is so lucky to have maintained this system continuously for almost 200 years. We're very, very lucky for that and appreciative of the state for doing it.
Yeah, you have a good crowd here now.
Yeah, it's great. This is why we bring the boat to towns, and this is as rewarding for us as it can get.
Okay, well, Captain, I guess you and Josie Wales have to go entertain your customers.
Thank you. It's been wonderful talking to you, Bob.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, pleasure.
You can find more information on the Lois McClure and the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum online. The museum is in Basin Harbor, Vermont. Our next stop was in Gloversville, 227 Kingsborough Avenue, a former public school that now houses the exhibits of the Fulton County Museum. Well, we've arrived at the Fulton County Museum, and the book fair is getting underway, the second annual Lee and Priscilla Mitchell Book Fair. And some gentleman's here with a TV camera. Who are you?
My name's Mike.
Mike. And what are you doing here, Mike?
I'm from WFNY, and I'm here to interview you.
Well, Mike, what is WFNY?
WFNY is a TV and a couple of radio stations here in Gloversville, an AM and an FM.
Oh, very good. Well, it's nice. I remember you were here at this event last year.
Yeah, you were like a star to me. I'm like, oh, I'm going to meet Bob Cudmore.
Okay. Well, do you want to ask me some questions?
Well, sure. How many years have you been in the broadcast business?
About 50.
And how many years have you been in the author business?
Probably about, turn of the century. So 17 years.
Which do you enjoy more?
Oh, I like them both. I'm still doing a little bit of both. I do a little talk show in a station in Albany. And I also do this podcast, a weekly podcast called The Historians, which is, an audio production. It's on my website, Apple iTunes, things like that. Oh, it's bobcudmore.com.
Let's talk about your books. How did you go from broadcasting and you said, hey, I'm going to write a book?
Well, it started when I worked on a historic documentary about my hometown of Amsterdam, New York, with WMHT and their producer, Steve Dunn. After that, I talked the Daily Gazette into letting me do a regular column on local history, which it turns out to be mainly a column about Amsterdam and to some extent Fulton County as well. And since then, I've done, three history books with an outfit called History Press, starting with Stories from the Mohawk Valley, Hidden History of the Mohawk Valley, and Lost Mohawk Valley.
So this, what will a reader find in these three books?
Well, there's stories, for example, about Benjamin Paul Blood, who was the psychedelic philosopher, experimented with mind-altering chemicals back in the early 1900s and was a friend of the great philosopher William James, got James to do the same thing. The mind-altering chemical they were using was nitrous oxide, which is called laughing gas. It's typically was used then in dental procedures.
In doing this, you and I both have a fondness for our area. The Mohawk Valley, the county of Montgomery County, Fulton County. We love this area very much, right?
Yeah, I do.
So what do you got in the plans now? Anything new coming out?
Well, nothing. I haven't decided on a new book, or I haven't written a new book. I continue to write the weekly column and, do the podcast. I brought my flyers along, trying to maybe drum up donations for the podcast. Maybe I'll write another book. Collection of stories, because I have written enough columns, but, don't know if I'll do another book.
A couple of treasures we have. Not only are you a treasure for what you have given us, these will outlast all of us, but this museum is incredible. The bookstore, Mysteries on Main Street, what a great little store right downtown Johnstown.
That's true, and I always enjoy coming here to this museum to speak or going to the bookstore, Mysteries on Main, to do a book signing. It's a very good store and good place.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us.
You bet.
All right, thank you. Bob Cudmore.
By the way, the Fulton County Museum is operated by the Fulton County Historical Society. And we continue at the Priscilla and Lee Mitchell Book Fair at the Fulton County Museum, and we're joined by Patty Locatelli, who is the currently managing the bookstore, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I'm the manager at Mysteries on Main Street.
You do know what you do for local authors. I mean, it's everybody who writes local books knows that they have a friend at Mysteries on Main Street.
I really hope that they know that, because I really enjoy supporting the local authors, and it's so much fun to talk to everyone and hear how they're going in their process of writing and see how they're doing and to see each new book that they bring out. It's really very exciting at the store when that happens. So,
can you tell me the story of this event, the book fair?
Well, the book fair, we actually, Marion Villione, and I don't know if you've run into her here, she actually approached me. She's a regular customer at the store, and she said, you know, I'd like to do something with some local authors. And I said, well, I know lots of those. So we actually started planning it out and put some feelers out there. I gave her a list of names. She had some names that she knew from the museum. And together we built, and like last year, it kind of exploded. Last year we ended up having 18 authors here. We grouped from that after, you know, everything, and we decided to do a little bit less this year and then like try to make this an annual thing. Mm-hmm. And so we actually ended up having 10 authors this year. And but especially with the nice pavilion out back now, we were able to, you know, fit in and have people more comfortably settled in here. And I think there's a lot of space here, and I think we're going to do this at least yearly. So mm-hmm. There's been a little bit talk about trying to do it twice a year, but we haven't quite pulled that off yet. So we'll see what happens. But
and this goes way back in your answer, Marion is with the museum, or she's a volunteer?
She's with the museum. I know she's on the board. I'm not exactly sure what her title is, honestly, but she's the people here at the museum. They've all been really supportive and helping to plan all this. You know, like I say, okay, here we have this group of authors, I'll get their books, but a lot of the they bring me in here, I kind of like set up, they help me do a map of where we're going to have everyone, and you know, the planning that they put together, the team here at the museum is amazing. Like, they are very organized people, and it's very helpful.
Why is it the Lee and Priscilla Mitchell Book Fair?
Well, I know that was actually a name suggested by the museum, and I thought it was a really good idea. Priscilla Mitchell, the owner of the store previously, she passed away around this time last year, and we decided that, you know, we were going to continue. You know, she passed away right before we did this last year, so we decided we were going to continue to do the event, and it definitely felt like it was in honor of her. And then when we were talking about it, you know, we couldn't do any of this without our husband, Lee. So it became the Priscilla and Lee Mitchell Author Fair. So, yep, they've been doing this for years. I know they originally started, I believe it was 94. Mm-hmm. But they've been, I mean, I've worked for them since 2004. So, like, they've been doing the bookstore in this community for a long time. So we thought, you know, if we're going to do something like this, it'd be nice to have it in honor of them. So
and the bookstore itself is in Johnstown.
Yes, the bookstore is in Johnstown, but we have a lot of customers, and we do a lot of things with both Johnstown and Gloversville and even the outlying communities around them. You know, like it takes a lot of we have a lot of talent locally, and it's really nice to showcase that at the store. And it's really, you know, we really appreciate our area.
Mysteries on Main Bookstore is at 144 West Main Street in Johnstown, New York. You can also find them online. You've been listening to the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore.